We want to welcome you to another episode of Bulletproof. I want to thank all my guests for making us now the number 5 podcast on Apple and the number 7 podcast on Spotify. But it's not because of myself or my voice. It's because I have these amazing guests. And today I have another one who I'm so happy to have on and I'm excited to speak to. We have Seamus McElarty, who is a special agent for the FBI. Seamus, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for coming on. And there's so much I want to get into you with today. We're going to start from the top. But when people say a special agent from the FBI, what is the difference from being a special agent to just being a regular FBI agent? Is there a difference?
There's no type of difference at all. It's just a title that they give you. It's just a special agent. It's just a title that they give you.
Now, is that something like if you kind of get promoted within the FBI or it's like a sergeant?
If you get promoted, then they start to go up to a supervisory special agent. Then there's an assistant special agent in charge. There's an SAC, which would be a special agent in charge. And then there's an assistant director in charge. And then there's the director of the FBI. Gotcha. So the entry level is a special agent.
Got it. And did you get on, if you don't mind me asking you, into the FBI? 1999. So you got on about 4 years after I became a police officer. But I didn't last. I only lasted 7 years at the NYPD. I got injured. But so you got on in the 90s when, again, it's funny because when I got on in 94, the guys that were on prior to me in the NYPD were like, oh, the job's not what it used to be. You know, and it was still pretty, I don't want to say cowboyish because I was already kind of done. But again, different times, no cell phones, no, you know, different. You were able to do a little more. And I like to say being a better cop, you know what I mean? Because you don't have to worry about, you know, how things, who's recording you and, you know. What would you say the biggest difference from today in the FBI as from when you first got on?
Well, I think now, as you just said, there's cameras involved, right? So I think the agents, when they go out, they have to have their cameras on, which is very, very different from, you know, before. Just what I did for 15 years was I specialized in the mob, and the mob is just not what it used to be. You know what I mean? I think the FBI has done a great job of trying to dismantle the mob, and that's one of the things that I've done. I have been very fortunate to be involved in the dismantlement of 3 families. And one of the reasons that I'm here today is I'm going to speak about a book that I had written was called Flipping Capo, How the FBI Dismantled the Real Sopranos. That was one of the families that I had helped try to dismantle.
And that's amazing. So you dismantled the Sopranos. I happen to have a role on the Sopranos for a little bit. So we have a lot in common. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
Again, yes, in the 90s, that was still, the mafia was still, you know, prevalent, right? Although we're going to talk a little bit later, if we have time, about what just happened in the NBA.
But exactly, yep.
Before we do that, so when you get on, you're focusing on that, right? Now, when you're focusing on all 3 families, do you have like a branch or of different guys working undercover in all 3 families, or were you focusing on one at a time?
Okay, so at that point in time, 1998, I get assigned to a squad called C-10. C-10 is responsible for 2 families at that particular time. It's the Bonanno family and the DiCavalcanti family, which is the Jersey family. And you're probably thinking, okay, how does the New York FBI get involved with the Jersey family? How that started was someone decided to rob the World Trade Center in 1998. That person, the mastermind behind it, was a gentleman named Ralph Guarino. So the people that actually robbed the World Trade Center got caught rather quickly. Ralph was the mastermind behind it, and he realized that he was going to get caught pretty quickly, and he called an agent named George Hanna, and George was smart enough to basically turn him into a witness. He turned him into a proactive witness. What I mean by that is he made consensual recordings. When you have a proactive witness, you just never know where that witness is going to bring you. What I mean by that is what families he's going to ingratiate himself into. And he brought us into the Brooklyn faction of the DiCavalcanti family. And that's how the FBI started to get into the DiCavalcanti family. So my squad, C-10, then basically start to investigate the Bananas plus the Cavalcantes. Me as a new agent, I get assigned in December of 1999 after graduating from Quantico, and also then going through a rotation. That's what they do when you first get to the New York office. I get assigned to that squad. Very fortunate to do that. And I get assigned to the DeCavalcanti section of that particular squad. And we investigate that family. We run Ralph proactively for almost 2 years up until December of 1999. And we have our first big arrest where we arrest 39 people.
Now, again, I'm familiar with them, obviously, for being from New York, the Cavalcante family. There, again, for some reason, it's always the Bonomos, right? And oh my God, well, just correct me, help me with the other family. I'm sorry, the
There.
Bonomos and the
So you have the Bananos, you have the Colombos, the
Colombo,
Lucchese, the
right? And the
Genovese,
Lucchese.
Gambino.
For some reason, and again, yeah, right, the Gambinos. I probably know a lot of guys from there, from those
Yeah.
old companies. The Cavalcanti, I'm familiar with them, but how come they didn't get the same, as far as the names, with the Bonomos and all? How come
Right.
they're not as
Because they're
familiar?
based in New Jersey, and they're not as they weren't as big as the five families in New York. And basically, the five families in New York control the country. So they were known as the sixth family. And at that particular time in like the early 1990s, they were kind of they were viewed as a farm team, really. So they were, and they were basically aligned with the Gambino family at that particular time. And what the book will discuss, one of the murders that had occurred that kind of put them on the map was the murder of Fred Weiss, who was from Staten Island. He was killed on, unfortunately, September 11th of 1989. And it's probably the most indictable mob murder ever, where I think at least 15 people have either pled guilty or have been convicted of that murder. They killed him because John Gotti thought he was cooperating. Pure paranoia. The reason that they thought he was cooperating was because he switched lawyers. That's the only reason that they thought he was cooperating. He switched lawyers, so they killed him. But he was from Staten Island. And basically, the gentleman came out of his apartment building, and I think it was on Wellington Place, I believe, if I
Yeah, good
got that
memory.
correct.
Yeah, that was in my command, believe it or
Yeah,
not.
yeah. And he came out, and basically, Vincent Palermo and James Gallo shot him, and my witness, Anthony Capo, was the driver. Killed him, and as I said, 15 people at least have either pled guilty or been convicted of that murder. And it was a race between two families, John Gotti and the Gambinos and the DeCavalcantes, to kill him. And numerous people in the DeCavalcantes were a part of that murder. And that was kind of trying to put them on the map to kind of get, as you just said, get up to even ranking with the other families.
Now, you had would you say that that was the family that was based on The Sopranos?
I would say so. And there's a lot of similarities between the show and real life. For instance, in the first season, the real boss dies of stomach cancer, right? In real life, Jacob Maury dies of stomach cancer in June of 1997. Kind of ironic, right?
It is,
You have a
yeah.
lot of plots between both the show and real life. The union angle, where the DeCavalcantes control Local 394, the labor union. They also started a union, 1030, which was the asbestos union. Then you also have the gay angle, where in real life, John D'Amato was the acting boss of the DeCavalcanti family. And my witness, Anthony Capo, shot him. I don't judge anyone, I don't really care. But as a boss of the DeCavalcanti family, they thought that he couldn't be running a family and be gay. What he used to do is he brought his girlfriend to sex clubs in New York City and would have sex with men. The girlfriend told Anthony Capo that and reported it to his superiors, and they decided that he had to be killed. That was one of the reasons that they killed him. The other reason was because he was borrowing money from other mob families, and he was basically ringing up a lot of gambling debts. So he was killed back in 1991. Another subplot to the actual show. You have the strip club angle, right? Where you have the strip club in New Jersey.
Thing.
In real life, Vincent Palermo was the acting boss of the family. Vincent Palermo had a strip club in Queens on Queens Boulevard called Wiggles. So there's a lot of subplots between the two. Also, the show started in January of 1999. We have a consensual recording from the person that I told you before, Ralph Guarino, who decided to proactively cooperate. He made a consensus recording in March of 1999, basically 3 months after the show had started, where we have a consensus recording which was priceless for trial that we played at trial, where we have made members of the DiCavalcanti family talking about the show, saying, "This is you, this is you, and this is you." It was priceless for trial. So
That's
they were
crazy.
actually even acknowledging themselves within the show. You have the record label portion of the show where you have the Jewish gentleman on the show. There was a real life guy. He wasn't Jewish, but there's a real life guy in the DiCavalcanti family who was very influential in the record industry as well. So there's a lot of subplots, and also the stock angle too, right? There was a gentleman from the DiCavalcanti family who was known as the Wizard of Wall Street. He was a captain from the DiCavalcanti family. His name was Phil Abramo, very smart man. He was the Wizard of Wall Street. So there's a lot of similarities between the show and also in real life. So even though the director says he wasn't speaking to anyone, it's just ironic that there's a lot of subplots between both the show and real life.
Yeah, somebody must have came up to David Chase and said, "Listen, I got something for you," which ended up being it was kind of brilliant because it ended up being one of the biggest shows of all time, ironically.
Exactly.
And you never go wrong with mob stories for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Middle America, everybody loves this, this part of the country and this part, the whole mafia angle.
And the thing that you were talking about before about having them on the same level, the thing that's interesting, and me as a new agent, I didn't even know what I had done, but if you read the book, you'll see this, is up until me arresting Anthony Capo, who was from Staten Island, and he was a soldier, known as a very violent person, hated by law enforcement, and really not well-liked within the mob, no one in that family in their 100-year history had ever cooperated with the government before, no made member. So I arrest him, and I get him to cooperate. So he's the first made member in their 100-year history to cooperate. That's in 1999. Basically, we get him to cooperate, and then we have a spiral effect of cooperation where in a 2-year period, we get about 7 people to cooperate, including the acting boss. So when we have a trial, we're able for the first time to put the whole structure on trial where we have an associate, a soldier, a captain, and an acting boss to actually testify live in trial. Amazing stuff. Now, since that time period in 2002, 2003, no other made member in that family has cooperated. So we're at 25 years and counting. So just think about that for a minute.
Yeah,
took
100,
100 years to flip someone and 25 years plus since someone has flipped since then. So that family has remained pretty strong, even though they took a beating and we basically dismantled them, because at the end of the day, we convicted 71 people, solved 11 murders, and had 7 trials during that 6-year period.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. So that whole stuff, so again, wasn't that the same year that that's the whole thing happened with Sammy, when he was actually flipping, or was that?
Well, Sammy flipped earlier. He was one of the first ones to flip in the early 1990s, right? Like 90,
54.
I don't know, like 92 or something like that. So
was that really? It was 92.
Something like that. It was the early,
wow.
like 1990s.
Yeah.
And then he screwed up, right? He got a great deal, and then he kind of screwed that up, and then he went to jail for 20 years. He's out now, and
yeah.
I think he's doing podcasts too, from what I hear,
Right.
But Anthony Capo, basically, we got him to cooperate. He testified for me 7 times, and that's not even including the times that he was prepped for trial, that people decided to plead guilty because he knew that he was that good of a witness. And the guy basically did change his entire life. He went from being a psycho to being a professional witness for the government.
It's pretty wild. That's wild. I mean, the whole thing is so interesting. I mean, again, growing up in that time, being from Staten Island, and the joke used to be, Staten Island was either cops, firemen, or gangsters. That was like the
yeah.
it was what.
And he had a vicious reputation. There was even a story, because what happens, and this is something that happens in the book is, and I think it's not, it hasn't been done before, where I explain the process. I explain what a proffer is, how you cooperate with the government. These are all things that I discuss within the book. But there's one story where he actually stabbed a guy in the face with a fork. It's like that shows you how ruthless he was. You know what I mean? So you can just imagine when I'm sitting there taking notes, I have an eye raised when I'm hearing all the stories that he's telling me. You know what I mean? So it really was, especially as a new agent at the time, listening to like basically 25 years of his criminal history and all the violent acts that he actually had done. You know what I mean? It really was interesting to hear, especially as like a new agent.
And again, that's and coming out of the box, that
Yeah.
this is what you start, this is where you guys
Yeah.
started.
Yeah. And it's
I
like,
love that.
as I said, it led to dismantling the family, which was just an amazing stuff. And the thing, one and one of the reasons people ask me, why did you write the book? So one of the reasons that I wrote the book was because
Oh,
the
before wait, before
public.
wait, wait, hold on, hold on, hold that thought. Everybody that's listening, because we have an abundance of listeners. I want to make sure we get this in. Please share the name of the book and
It's
how they can
cool.
get.
Yep. It's called Flipping Capo: How the FBI Dismantled the Real Sopranos. You can go to the website, which is called flippingcapo.com. You can go to Barnes and Noble, or you can go to Amazon. As I said, I think it's a very unique book because it's from the FBI's perspective, and
That's great.
it gives you an insight on lots of things, even like loan sharking. You hear these words, but I explain how loan sharking really works and how profitable it is for the mob. And then I take you through the cooperation process. I take you through WITSEC, how the witness security program works. I take you through trials and how a lot of things happen at trials. And I had a year of trials from December 2002 up until October 2003. That was a year of like no life, really, to tell you the truth. And I show you how trials work and what happens behind the scenes. So I really do think it's a really good read.
No, I'm excited to read. I love all that stuff. Again, partly because I was not, again, I'm not involved, but partly because I knew a lot of those guys that, not only that you mentioned, but a lot of other guys that we, but not to flip, I want to come back to this, but we just had something unique that just happened, timely wise. It happened with the NBA scandal.
Yep.
All these guys got NBA coaches, players, a lot of people. I mean, they're taking down a lot. Were you surprised in today's day and age that something of that magnitude could still happen and go on? Because again, people don't really even think of them. I'm not saying that they don't, they don't exist, because they totally do, but they're not as pre to me. Maybe I'm in Jersey now at Homedale, but they're not as prevalent as it used to be in my eyes. But maybe I'm wrong. Were you surprised when that broke?
Well, for the last week, I've been called a lot, and I keep hearing the mob is back. And what I tell them is the mob never left. It's like, we talked earlier before about the three families. So after I got done with the Jersey family, I was sent down to do the Colombo family. In 2011, I executed the largest mob arrest the FBI ever had, where we arrested 127 people that day. And everyone thought after that, the mob would be gone. They adapt. So fast forward, the same thing. They're not going away. They've been around for 125 years. They're smart guys within the mob. They're going to adapt. And what you just said, look at the techniques that they used. X-ray tables, contact lenses with cameras, chip trays with cameras. This is amazing stuff. Not to laugh, but it's almost like techniques that the FBI would use, right? It's kind of funny. But
Right.
unfortunately for them, the FBI was there watching the whole thing, right? But it doesn't surprise me at all. They're always going to adapt. What they want is they want to be under the radar. You and me both know the mob hated John Gotti. They hated
Of
Gotti
course.
because he was so flashy and because he was always, putting his nose at the FBI. So the mob doesn't want you to know they exist. They want to be under the radar. They're not going away. So this doesn't surprise me. It's just what did surprise me is the techniques that they used, that they were pretty smart about it. Unfortunately, they actually got caught. And now people say to me, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next is 34 people got arrested. Someone's going to flip. They're
Of
always
course.
going to. So
Of
I
course.
expect more indictments, people to try to plead out pretty quickly to get out of the case. I expect more people to flip. So that's going to lead to more indictments. So it's not
Were
over
you
yet. I think it's just getting started.
not surprised though on the level of people that were involved, like head coaches and players and the guy took himself out on because they have all those prop bets now.
Yep.
So the guy put maybe like he got hurt to so he.
I've been talking to people about this too. It's like there's a formula that the mob uses. It's gambling leads to loan sharking leads to extortion, and ultimately extortion can lead to violence. And I'll explain that. Okay, so you gamble and you lose money, right? So you got to cover those debts. So you go to the mob to get loan sharking. And in the book, I explain how that actually works. Then, if you can't pay your loan sharking debts, that can go to extortion. And in this case, I don't know all the details yet, but just looking from afar, this is what I'm surmising is players could have lost money, right? So now they have to work off their debt. How do you work off your debt? A form of extortion is me providing non-public information, such as I'm going to take myself out after the first quarter, or giving information that I have a bad knee or something, right? That's information that the bettors can say, okay, they're not going to go the over. They're going to be the under, and they're going to bet that. A second form of extortion is, okay, you could have a coach or a player and say, okay, guess what? You're going to be the headline for our card game tonight. So we're going to use your name to attract people to come to this card game. Come to our rigged card game, right? Where we're going to have six people sitting there, and the four of us have the card game rigged, and the two suckers that you brought to the card game don't know because you're the headline that they're going to get robbed. So that's a form of extortion. Where the mob has gotten smart, though, the last couple of years is related to violence. They know violence is going to attract law enforcement, so they're not going to hurt as many people now because they know that's going to be put them on the radar. So they've gotten smart about that. So the bottom line is, am I surprised? Not at all. They've been around for 125 years. They're going to always adapt. And the
That's
thing that
funny.
was funny about this, what people aren't talking about as much, is how they laundered the money. They laundered the money through crypto. Why crypto? Because it's not regulated yet. It's not regulated yet. So it's an untapped market. Like it has to be regulated. And until it is, it's fair game.
That's again, and when you think like you just said, it's brilliant, right? It's fucking, it's cool. I'm like I said, I'm taking it from a different perspective. Like, I'm like, because I'm not even thinking about the mob guys, I'm saying, these NBA players and coaches are making millions of. Upon millions of dollars. So, what is it really? One guy left the game. He came home. There was a $20,000 bag of cash. $20,000 when you're making 50 million is like me giving you a $5 bill.
But they're so competitive to bet, though. That's the thing. They have that in their blood that they're so competitive to bet. And as you just said, they got the money to piss away, right? So that's the thing. It's kind of a thing for them. It's like a juice for them, right? To actually try to bet. So I'm not surprised.
Wow. So that's crazy. Getting back to you when you were back in nine in the 90s, what is the craziest situation or the cra that you actually witnessed or were involved in being with the FBI? Or something that you know what? When you say, hey Steve, what's the craziest thing you ever saw on patrol? I throw a lot. There's one story I have that I could spit right out and tell you exactly where I was and what happened. What is that for Seamus?
Craziest story. When I was with the okay after this case, I got sent down to another squad to run the Colombo family. And what we did is when we found Wild Bill Cotullo, so he was the underboss of the Colombo family. They killed him in 1999, I believe, and they buried him on the island. And we had a gentleman came in named Joseph Compitiello. Joe Caves, what was his nickname? He comes in and he proffers. So when someone comes in and proffers, it's called like a queen for a day, and they tell you the crimes that they have. So just imagine sitting there, and he comes in and he tells you, okay, there's three bodies that are buried right next to each other. So the layman would think, okay, they're right next to each other. And I'm not too sure if you ever dug for a body before, but it's a
No.
very hard thing to find a body. It could be in your room right now and still be hard to find a body. So he tells us
Right.
that there's three bodies buried out next to Farmingdale, Long Island. So we immediately have to go out there because if the bad guys find out that he's talking, they might move the body. So we go out to the
Right.
island, and this is in September of 2008, and we're out there. And I've been very successful in the senses we have found five bodies during my career, but during this particular one, there's three bodies that we're trying to look for. They weren't right next to each other. They were 1.1 miles apart. So one was next to a train tracks. One was next to a building that was just rebuilt. And while Bill Cotullo was behind a field, the source told us it was behind a berm. So we had our evidence response team out there, and we were out there for 8 days. And my superiors are giving me crap every day, like, what's the update? Because you have the press out there, helicopters, everything. And we just couldn't find him. And our evidence response team basically they dug an Olympic-sized pool for me to basically show him he's not here. And then my teammates, our own squad, C-38, says, Seamus, do you mind if we get some shovels? Because we're just sitting around. And we got some shovels and we started digging ourselves. What the Columbos used to do back then is they would kill someone, put lime on top of the body. What lime does is it kills the smell but preserves the body. So we dug in one area, just our team ourselves, while evidence response team was at the other two locations. No good. Dead end. We start digging on a second site. We just randomly picked a spot. An agent just said, let's pick this spot. Next thing you know, we're digging, and
Sure as
I
shit.
see the white stuff. I'm like, holy shit. So we start digging, and next thing you know, I see a shoe. And I was like, jackpot. So we're not professionals, right? We stop. I go get the evidence response team. We come back. And sure enough, it turns out to be Wild Bill Cotullo. We're able to confirm it through DNA with his family. And his body was intact from his hips up. He had veneers, so we can ID it through the dental records. And you know, it's always good to give closure to a victim's family. And I always say too, especially in the mob, you can't pick your family, right? So it was really good to give closure to the family. But that's one story. We're able to solve a 9-year-old murder, you know. But that's just one thing that pops out of at my head, you know, that we were able to solve.
No, that's amazing. And I mean, Wild Bill was huge. I mean, he was on the level of Gotti and all those guys. You know, I mean, Gotti's Gotti because Gotti, like he said, was the way he was. But as far as all those, you know, he's right up there, Wild Bill. I mean, that's pretty crazy.
And they killed him because he let his guard down. Alley Boy Persico was the
Perfect.
boss of the family, the acting boss of the Colombo family at the time, because Carmen Persico was the official boss in jail, and Alley was getting ready to go to jail. And while Bill thought he was going to get the keys to the kingdom, meaning he thought he was becoming the acting boss when Allie was going to go to jail. And if you know the history of the Colombo family, they had a violent war in the early 1990s, and the Colombo family never forgets. It was the Arenas versus the Persico faction, and Allie was not going to do that. And unfortunately, Wild Bill thought that he was going to do that, give him the keys of the kingdom, and they lured him to Dino Saraceno's house in Brooklyn. And as he was walking in the back of the basement, Dino Calabro shot him in the back of the head. Dino Calabro actually ended up becoming a witness for the government as well. And, you know, we were very lucky to dismantle that family too.
It's pretty crazy. Wow. Wild stuff. Now you've obviously taken down a lot of, you know, again, just in this small conversation, you're talking major crime families. Has there ever been, either with you or someone close to you, any repercussions where somebody says, wait a minute, this fucking guy Seamus, you know, well, let's go after, you know, McElhinney. So,
Well, when you read the book, you'll read that. But I will tell you, initially with Capo, what happens is, since he's the first made member to ever cooperate in that family, there was a contract that was put on him and his family and on law enforcement in general. One of the people that comes forward, you know, those arrests that I told you in December of 1999, that was the first level arrest. I arrest Capo, I get him to cooperate. We then get a bunch of people to cooperate, Vincent Palermo, Victor DiChiara. We use all their information, Capo, Palermo, and Victor, to then do October of 2000, October 19th of 2000, the hierarchy arrest. So it's 25 years now. The anniversary was just a couple of weeks ago, where we arrest the official boss, the two acting panel bosses, the consigliere, and a bunch of people. Out of those people, Frank Scarabino comes forward and he cooperates. What he tells us, and as I said, you never know what someone's going to tell you until you sit down with them, right? He tells us
Right.
that he's got the contract to kill Capo's family and his kids and to hurt law enforcement. So the answer is yes. It was very scary. It was a jolt, right? That, here I am, a new agent. I'm the handler for Capo, so of course I'm concerned. But then to fast forward, I worked the mob for so many years. There's recordings out there that they think I'm a decent guy. The reason that I say that is because I've always treated them with respect. That's just the way that I was raised. So if I got you, I got you. If I don't, I don't. If I know that you did it and I don't have you then. You know what I mean? So I think
Right.
there's a level of respect. But yes, early on, I think there was reason to be concerned, but now I don't think so.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
I think if anything was going to happen, it would have
Yeah.
already happened. I think time has gone on. Again, if Sammy's walking around of all fucking people, I think you're all right. I think you're
Yeah.
good. You're just doing your job. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's the thing, as I said, I've always treated people with respect. I think that's the right thing to do because, as I've said before, if I w was arrested, I would expect the same thing, right? As I said, you have family, you can't pick your family. So when you get locked up, it's an emotional day for your family, right? So
Right.
you just want to treat people with respect. And, if they decide to cooperate, great. If they don't, they don't. There's plenty of people, there's plenty of mob guys that I've had the cordial conversations with that didn't want to cooperate. It is what it is. There's no hard feelings.
Yeah, no, right. Nothing personal, just
Yeah,
business, right?
exactly.
Seamus, is again, we have a lot of listeners. I know
Yeah.
you're in a special field right now, in the private sector, so I'm not going to get into that. And I'm going to say something, but I think I already know the answer. You don't have a social media or something that you want people to get in touch with you or reach out to you about the book, or is there any way people can reach out to you, or you'd rather not even share that information?
Yeah, if you go to flippingcapo.com, you can reach me out there.
No worries, no problem.
Yes.
Listen, Seamus, that was. Again, I wish I had fucking 3 hours with you. Not a half. We could fill up like 3 hours worth of stuff here. I mean, especially like I said, so there's things I, people I grew up with, and I'm sure all the stuff that would have been great to discuss. And again, perhaps we'll do this again. I would love that. But
And I actually, it's a funny story. I went to Cardinal Spellman in the Bronx, right? And they had a raffle to have dinner with Vincent Pastore
Oh, that's
from,
funny. He's a good friend of mine.
right? So I actually, this is in 2018, I believe. So he was just supposed to have a quick hit with us. He ended up spending the whole night with us. And when I first told him what I did, he thought I was just full of shit. And then we
Good.
started to talk, and our conversation stays between us, of course. But he was a great guy. He actually let us take a picture with him. I sent him a text, and he let me put the picture in the book. So he was really a really like neat guy. So,
He's a great dude.
yeah,
He's a good
yep.
friend, and
Oh yeah,
that's
good,
why
awesome.
small world. So
Yep.
again, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. So much great information. And again, it's
Thank
so
you, Steve.
I'm such a homer with all this stuff. I love all this. I could talk about this all day. So again, Seamus McElarty, thank you so much for coming on. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Believe. We'd like to thank our listeners. Again, since we're 7-5, we could go up to 6-4. So again, it's not because of me. It's because of someone like Seamus who gives all these amazing stories. We'd like to thank Believe, our sponsor. We'd like to thank our listeners for making us a top 7-5, which also means we can go back down to 6-4. And again, it's not because of me. It's for guests like Seamus McElarty. and his amazing stories. And once again, Seamus, thank you so much for coming on today. I'm a fanboy now. You might have to get an order of protection against me because I'm a fanboy. So thank you again. And I would like to thank our listeners. And I can't wait to share this one with from you with all of my listeners. And Seamus, thank you so much for coming on.
Steve, thank you for having me. I've had a great time.
You coming back. I'm going to get you back.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you.
My pleasure. Have a great day. See you soon. All right. Bye-bye.
Later. Bye-bye.